You're listening to Ride Along, EMT School. I'm Mike.
And I'm Max. We're two students navigating EMT school, bringing you along week by week.
And I'm Jonathan, paramedic, bringing real-world perspective.
Join us as we share the lessons, challenges, and stories from EMT school, and hear insights from those already living the EMS life. Welcome to the Ride Along. And we're back.
We're back, people.
For episode 7.
Staying alive. CPR certification night.
Ha, 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 ha. Staying alive. Staying alive. Ha, 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 ha. Staying alive. Sorry.
Okay, we can't talk about CPR and the Bee Gees song without talking about the episode of The Office where they're getting CPR.
Yes, certified. Well, that's why the name of this episode is Staying Alive.
Yep. He might be an Office fan.
Oh, I'm definitely an Office fan.
I never got into that show.
No?
No, Steve Carell, I couldn't do it.
Oh, that's a shame because it's Americana comedy.
Like, I don't disagree. It's one of those ones that I need to turn back on.
Do you do Parks and Rec?
I did a little bit, yeah.
Parks and Rec is really good,
too. It is really good.
Between those two, I find most of my comedic inspiration.
It's good to know where it comes from.
It didn't look very realistic in the movie. Turns out it was.
Oh, man. So in my head, when I think of myself being in the emergency services role, I always feel like I'm performing like Dwight in The Office. Like, I feel like I'm so over the top all the time. Like, because it's hard sometimes not to go gung ho and just be like, okay, we're doing this thing. And like totally on the other side, you wind up looking back at yourself and going, man, I was such a tool.
Well, also because like through the training we've done, like making it real for yourself is kind of it's just part of the program.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so like it's kind of hard not to be like, okay, this is serious. This is happening. Let's treat it seriously.
Well, speaking of which, I think Dwight Schrute is probably the best example of somebody who takes training seriously, because one of my favorite episodes of that show is when he starts the fire in the stairwell of the office, yeah. And he like locks the door and then like heats it up with a blowtorch. And he like sets a smoke grenade off and he's like, all right, people, now it's time for the fire alarm. Better know what to do. And nobody can get out because all the doors are locked and they're like crawling up through the drop ceiling and everyone's panicking. And he's just going, he's got like his stopwatch out and just like timing everybody.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I think that's an effective I bet you they all learned how to get out of the building that day.
So if you want to check out The Office, you can see a real world training scenario performed by Dwight.
But yeah, so this episode we are talking about CPR.
Yes.
Max and I reached I don't know if it's a milestone per se, a landmark class in the sense that we had to get a certification.
Yep. It was the first one so far.
Well, I think it's out of the certificate, we'll get an EMT certification at some point, but I think this is the only other real one that we get. It's like separate.
That vehicle class might have certifications go along with it.
Maybe. But, I don't know. But
it was good to do. First of all, it's a refresher because we've both been certified in CPR previously.
I have gotten a CPR cert before.
So it was good to kind of refresh that whole mental process and also see a few things that were new or different. And our instructor was very good.
I liked him a lot.
Yeah.
He was cool. He was a flight medic.
Yep.
And I think he mentioned that he was the QA or the quality assurance and the quality assurance administrator for the county.
Yeah.
Which seems like a really interesting role to be in terms of like, hey, we're going to make sure that everyone is, you know, doing really good patient care across the countywide system. So, love to kind of pick that guy's brain some. So
for sure.
Anyway, so we did CPR certification night.
Yep.
And it was a Wednesday.
It was, we had three, well, me too. But Mike had three nights of instruction that week.
It was a rough week. It was like, I was like at class every night that week.
He was. he loved it.
Usually
he
was, it's two nights a week.
He was fresh as a daisy.
Yep. This week was three nights. It's, I think, the only night we have, or only week we have where it's a three-night week. But
correct.
But yeah, it was singular focused, just CPR, just certification. But that comes with a lot of different information, and it's important.
Yeah.
So that will, you know, we've already kind of started talking about it, but like the medical term of the week, I think is kind of the thing that's going to, to set the tone for tonight. And that is high quality CPR.
It was repeated so many times.
Yeah, it's a term. Like it is a coined term, high quality CPR. And for those unaware, CPR stands for cardiopulmonary resuscitation, which is the process of providing chest compressions and rescue breathing combined together to basically function the cardiovascular and pulmonary system of an unconscious person.
Yep.
I think that's probably a pretty good simplification of it.
We are circulating air and blood around the body for somebody who is unable to do so themselves.
Right. Yeah. You're putting air in and out and you're making blood go round and round for them.
Yep.
Instead of them doing it for themselves.
Because they can't.
Because they can't, because it's stopped. And that is what CPR is, but there are some factors to quote unquote high quality CPR, which is what we are to aim and strive for, especially as medical professionals and that, emergency medical technicians.
That was one of the things that I really love, is that you're not hamstringed. You're given this protocol. This is what you're doing. You're not hamstringed like you are as a civilian, where you have your limitations. And it's kind of nice to have that, like that checklist of what you're needing to do.
Mm-hmm. So, what does high quality CPR mean? We had a little powwow before this, just to kind of come up with the summation of what are the kind of key factors. And we've kind of identified a few. The big one being the early assessment of the need for CPR, right? Like if somebody is down, like making sure that they do not have a pulse, they are not breathing quickly, and assessing that they need help, right? Like don't dilly dally, like don't sit there forever trying to get the perfect pulse. If they don't have it, get on to CPR. Quick activation of the emergency response system to get more help to you, because at the end of the day, you could do perfect, amazing, long-lasting CPR, but if somebody isn't coming to help you, you're going to be there a long time.
Yeah, it's so absolutely necessary.
And the way that like differentiates between a lay person providing CPR, they're going to initiate that alert through the 911 system or whatever's appropriate for their area. And then us as medical providers who've been called to help somebody, we're going to let our dispatch know that we are working an active code, or we have a code blue.
Yep.
And then that is going to hopefully get us another tone of alerts. And we're going to be able to get additional resources on the way to help us perform CPR.
Mm-hmm.
So
important, because
yes,
more help is better.
Yep.
Apparently, you know, and once you do start CPR, compressions of the correct rate and depth.
Yes.
Are very important.
Yep.
Especially I will harp on this one point, more than the others. And that is the full, expansion, or full recoil of the chest when it's coming back up, because without the full expansion, the full recoil of the chest coming out, the heart is not filling with blood again.
Yeah.
So you can do a bunch of compressions, but if the heart isn't refilling, it's not pushing blood anywhere, and you're not creating a vacuum, and you're not pulling blood out of the extremities into the heart to then circulate that, you know, oxygenated blood, perfusion. One of the terms that we learned last week.
That was a term.
So, yes, those things are kind of qualities of high quality CPR, as well as early use of an AED, an automated external defibrillator, because those can be game changing when it comes to getting a heart back going in its proper rhythm.
Yeah,
because it doesn't, right. Unlike the movies, it does not start a heart. Like it doesn't go, like the thing doesn't go and then you shock them and then all of a sudden it goes beep.
Yeah, but that's beep. Not what the movie shows.
I know the movies are wrong.
It's a shame. Sad.
They've been lying to me
all along. Shows, all along. Movies.
So the Jonathan, double check me here, because I'm trying to remember what the, is it ventricular fibrillation and ventricular tachycardia? Are those the two shockable?
Yeah.
Those are the two shockable.
Ventricular tachycardia and ventricular fibrillation, yes.
VTAC and VFib.
Nice job.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, sometimes I can recall stuff. Those are the only two shockable rhythms from an AED, or at least the AEDs that I'm aware of.
Yes.
I don't know if there's, you know, super awesome paramedic AEDs that work in different ways, but.
Well, and there's some different terminology, but for defibrillation, yeah.
Okay.
VTAC and VFib are going to be the two rhythms that we're going to shock with the AEDs.
Cool. So yes, early use of an automated external defibrillator, which just talks you through the process.
It's and, so easy.
And might even, you know, help you perform CPR. I started looking into some AEDs recently, and there are some out there that will even tell you how you're doing when you're doing chest compressions and, you know, all other types of stuff.
So there are ones that even give you the compression rate. I've seen one that we used in one class where it had like a little metronome noise to give you that compression rate.
So those are the qualities of high, or those are the aspects of high quality CPR.
Yep.
And there's a bunch of other things that you should know and that relate to properly providing it. If you can stick to those things, you know, that's kind of like, you know, the highest quality you can give.
And you'll give your patient the best chance of, you know, recovering.
Exactly. So with that, I'm sure you've never given CPR in the field, right, Jonathan?
Oh man, more times than I can count on my hands and toes, fingers and toes.
And you still have all of those.
I still have all of them. Okay. Yes.
So more than 20.
More than 20. Yeah. It is one of the things that we emphasize the most, because I mean, we have that focus on airway, breathing, circulation, and this is something has stopped that, and CPR is our intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Something has stopped, you know, that airway from doing its airway thing, the breathing from doing its breathing thing, and the blood from circulating all around the body. So we have to intervene, and we have to intervene early with CPR for it to be effective. Otherwise, if we don't have blood pumping and air going in and out, we start getting tissue death. We start losing, brain tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And the body just ultimately perspires.
Yeah.
Or expires.
Expires. Well, it might perspire too, I guess.
They might perspire as well. Excuse me.
Well, let me ask you a question, because this is one of the things that stuck with me from the week. We're EMT candidates, I guess, or EMT in students. Training. Sure. Yeah, students. Recruits, whatever you want to call it. We're learning EMS or learning CPR, a BLS skill, right? A basic mm-hmm. life support. As an ALS provider, do you perform CPR?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now. Okay,
go ahead.
Well, because the string that I'm making here is that, okay, you're quite a few steps ahead of us in terms of years and experience, but we're learning that skill. You perform that skill. I bet you if we had an ER doc here, we could ask them like, hey, do you still need to know how to perform CPR? He would go, yeah, because we do that a bunch. And you know, everything up to a surgeon or something, like, you know, all along that kind of like you know, paradigm or pyramid of medical skills and training, I think this is one of those things that like everybody needs to know it because it's a basic skill that you need to fall back to.
It's a basic foundation of something that you're going to have to do and that you should be able to do.
And even if, let's say somebody's role in CPR is not necessarily directly doing compressions,
mm-hmm.
they still need to be aware of what's going to happen and what are the requirements and needs of somebody that is having CPR done to them. Because like in the instance of a physician, you know, I've seen physicians do chest compressions, but they've got other people to do that.
Right.
Their whole goal is to lead during the cardiac arrest.
Right.
And so they make the decisions and they give the guidance and the feedback to people. But they may not be taking that direct role in providing compressions or rescue breaths because they've got a whole team of people right. that specialize in various aspects of that that CPR process. So and as an ALS provider in the field, that sometimes is the case as well, where I may not be doing compressions, but I may be leading the team and guiding them, or I may be doing other ALS related skills,
mm-hmm.
but that's further down the road of intervening into a cardiac arrest. At the fundamental level, it's airway, breathing, circulation.
Right. And the reason I kind of bring this up is because, you know, as you know, somebody that's going into emergency medicine, as somebody who is, you know, or somebody who's been in it a while, or somebody that is a literal doctor in it, you're not always that. Sometimes you're just Jonathan on the street, or you're not Dr. Schneike, you're Jim, and you're in the grocery store or whatever, you know, like it, at certain times you always, you know, fall outside of that professional world. And it's still a skill that is very important to know. That's why, you know, there's CPR classes that you can go take. CPR is just a really important skill yeah. that everyone should have because it's probably the simplest, most effective form of keeping somebody alive that needs it right now. And,
right.
And it can be, it's simple enough, or they've come up with really good ways to teach it and to help people memorize it, and even mnemonics or stupid things as, you know, as simple as, you know, providing compressions at the rate of staying alive. Like those things exist to help people better perform CPR, which may be in a professional setting or you may encounter anywhere else.
I mean, it's BLS, sure. It's basic life support.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that anyone that's not doing continuing education, that's not focusing on those things, I think they're cheating themselves, and ultimately they could be cheating their patients, because we all know in the things that we've learned how many times the basics are the things that kind of get sloppy, and just touching up on those things makes you more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other aspect is, you know, as you guys are in this journey to become certified as EMTs, what will happen is in some places to maintain your EMT certification, you must have a valid CPR card.
Mm-hmm.
And if you decide to do this as a volunteer or even as a career, a lot of times your departments will have a policy that states you will have a valid CPR card to be able to continue doing whatever you're doing, volunteering mm-hmm. or working. So, you know, it's one of those things. You know, I think we're talking offline a little bit about the standards of CPR and kind of the guidelines and recommendations that are put forth by the different certifying bodies, the most prominent of which being the American Heart Association, that kind of set the standard for everybody mm-hmm. in you know, basic cardiac life support and advanced cardiac life support and all the things. So, you know,
and that's the program that we took. It was it was an AHA, American Heart Association. Yeah,
American Heart Association.
CPR class. But let me ask, because you had mentioned that they require you to have an active CPR certification. How long does that last?
Typically 2 years. Typically
but,
2 years.
And, but it's one of those things like even somebody who is, you know, a professional, like somebody who's earned their certification through basically the level of an associate's degree, every 2 years still has to go and get a CPR certification.
Yep.
Yeah.
With like, and there might be other continuing education things that you do along the way too, but that's the one that's like, oh, you know, you got to keep current on CPR because it seems like things change.
They do
a bunch.
It's funny how that works.
Yeah. At one point, you know, they had completely went away from lay responders, or just, you know, regular folks out there who happen to be CPR certified and they don't work in healthcare. They changed it to where they were just doing hands only CPR. So they were doing compressions, but then they weren't doing any sort of rescue breathing.
Yep.
And, you know, because they thought the thought process at the time was there's enough oxygen circulating in your body, in your bloodstream and in your lungs to for at least that first 6 minutes, you know, be good enough. And what they've discovered is it just doesn't have favorable outcomes. So that has went to the wayside, and that's a change.
Yeah.
We're back to rescue breathing for people, which it should have never went away to begin with. But,
Well, there's always the caveat, though, that sometimes you may, like, as a provider or as a lay person, a lay responder, you, like, because at the end of the day, you're the most important person there. Right. Like you have to, your safety, 100%. Your health has to be paramount over the patient. Like that's just the way it works. Like if you aren't alive, then you can't help other people. So like the idea of, well, if that person looks like they have some sort of communicable, you know, bloodborne pathogen, something that you don't want to put your mouth on or what, like if there's any reason why you think it would be unsafe to provide rescue breathing, like that is, you know.
Then default to
just chest compressions or hands only CPR.
Yep.
And that's a perfect point, right? Like, you know, we were talking a little bit about some of the equipment that is used during CPR. And I mean, if you don't have a pocket mask or a face shield, and you know, you guys are 100% correct. And here's the thing about just to throw this caveat in there. You know, here's the thing. We don't necessarily know who, based on looking at them, has some sort of communicable disease.
Right.
So
precautions. I mean, I'm 98% sure.
Yeah. By his looks alone.
Oh yeah. He gives me that look.
That's fair. You know,
and I'm pretty fair. Sure that says
I've seen some things.
Yeah.
And you've been exhibiting signs of tuberculosis, right?
Well, like, something lately. That's for sure.
but that's why we say universal precautions, because they're utilized with every patient we have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
there's a lot of things we learned, and like those are kind of like the big overview type things of, you know, what we talked about before, quality. You know, it's something to keep on top of. Things change. I remember going through CPR training when I was probably like 15. I think I did it as part of the Boy Scouts, and the compressions to breaths ratio was different than what it is now.
10 to 1 the first time I did it.
10 to 1.
Yep.
I think it was 5 to 2 when I first did it, or maybe something close to that. It changes because I think this is an interesting aspect of the medical field, is that it changes for a reason. They're not just like, you know, willy nilly being like, hey, you know, let's try this. They have data and they have field experience and they can look at statistics to know what is working, what isn't working. So they want to make sure that, you know, everybody out there is staying up to date, and they want to put the best, you know, the best methodology out there to help patients. So I think that's actually kind of a testament to the science of CPR in the medical field, especially for this one skill that like almost anybody can attain.
And the idea that they're continuing trying to perfect it, continuing to try to like sharpen the point of what is going to be the best result for the patient, which I think is what they should be doing.
Mm-hmm. So there were some key concepts to CPR that we learned. And it started, obviously, there's different pieces of the CPR process, right? Like it's two things. There's heart and lungs, blood and air, right? It started with airway, and kind of, you know, cause that's a common theme. So I think it was because it was the first thing that they handed to us when we walked in the class was like the shiny red, pocket, valve, mask, whatever pocket it's mask. The pocket mask, which, I think everyone went cool. And then we didn't touch them. Like, cause everybody, we were using bag valve masks for the rest of the night, but like those things come in handy. They can fit in different places. It's a one-way valve with a pocket mask that goes over a patient's mouth. Good to have with you if you ever do need to do CPR. I don't know how often those things get used unless you're carrying them in a specifically designed thing that is meant for CPR. But
well, I mean, the one nice thing about this one they gave us, it, before everyone I've seen, it's been a hard plastic case, like clamshell.
Yeah.
That one's a little bit
softer.
This one being softer, you're able to be a little more pliable with it. Like I could easily see putting that in a pocket.
Well, you can put it in a, I don't think anybody's carrying that in their pocket unless they're a lifeguard. Like
I'm thinking like a pocket in a backpack or whatever.
Yeah, in a backpack maybe. But I'm also a fan of those. I remember taking CPR class when my daughter was born. We did adult and infant CPR, and they gave us the little pocket mask that's like a keychain.
Yeah,
like it's in a little nylon pouch that you put on your keychain, face shield, pull that out, put it over someone's mouth. It's a one-way valve.
Yep.
I think those are really effective too. But this class was a bit more focused on
let's focus on the EMT, not the civilian
healthcare provider.
Yeah, exactly.
Airways, one of the things that I don't know how you felt, Max. I was struggling with it throughout the night is getting a good seal on the mask. Mm-hmm. Especially with the dummies, I always find them really difficult to get the right chin angle, and you have to like really move them really far back to be able to.
Right. In one statement, like okay, for the infant and for child, like don't tilt the head back as far. The only way we got a good seal was to crank the hell out of the neck. I mean, granted, it's a dummy. I understand, but it's like if you're trying to practice a specific skill that's different from normal, you would think that the apparatus you're using would coincide with that, not require you to jack it like the head's about to pop off.
Well,
it would be nice.
I have a theory, and I want to ask you, Jonathan, because you have the real world experience.
Mm.
And I assume you've used those CPR dummies a bunch.
Yeah.
A time or two. Is it as difficult to get an open airway from a patient, like, you know, laying with their head flat? And like doing a head tilt chin lift, is it as finicky on a real patient as it is on those dummies, or do the dummies add like an extra set of difficulty so that you're basically overemphasizing or kind of making sure you get the technique right when you get into the field? I'm just curious.
I would say that the issues between the dummies and a human being are different.
Okay.
I would say that I actually just helped a coworker do her CPR certification, and we were having a very similar issue. Actually, it was Thursday night, so it was after you guys had already done yours on Wednesday night. But she was having a very similar issue to getting a good seal on the mannequin. To get adequate rescue breaths, and these mannequins at this facility actually had feedback devices, and so they had to be within that ideal range for her to actually pass her certification.
Yeah.
So she was having some difficulty. The reality is there are going to be some issues that can keep you from getting a seal. Significant facial hair can be an issue depending on its stage of growth. That's why we have the ability with our CPR mask to adjust, hopefully to adjust how much air is in there so we can get a good seal.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is lots of people with dentures, if their dentures are out, it can be very, very difficult to get a seal when their dentures are out. So the issues are different, but I find that the mannequins are not a good representation of what actual patients are going to be like.
Flesh is just going to react differently.
Yeah.
My theory is that they create a dummy that you have to over commit to, or not over commit, but like emphasize the head, the chin lift, so that in the field you don't forget to do it, or you do it with enough motion. But
well, the issue is, I think you may be onto something, but I think some of the issue is that the rest of that dummy is not anatomically correct.
And there's only enough. Yeah.
Doesn't have enough weight. You're not going to be in the proper position. I mean, really, you got to you got to put them on the ground, and it's a whole thing.
And it's not going to have the same resistance. You're not actually blowing up a set of lungs. Like there's going to be all different types of there's probably no substitute for a real body. But
the rigidity of those mannequins is almost too much in comparison to actually providing care on an actual person. Did they talk about the ideal C clamp if you're single rescuer and getting that mask to seal? Yeah, you can absolutely get a better grip most of the time on an actual person than you can on that mannequin.
Mm-hmm. Right. Cause as you're gripping, it's not sliding up the pad.
Right. Like the contours of the human face are different. The rigidity of skin and bone is different than that hard plastic or that foam that you're utilizing on those mannequins. So, but one thing you got to think about is those things are produced at a price point.
Of course.
And they're produced at a price point, and they're produced to be convenient to carry around, not necessarily to be the most high fidelity experience and training. So.
Yeah.
But it's a way to approximate the process.
And there's got to be some kind of standardization if you're going to do it nationwide. Like you have to have something that these schools or the facilities or the ambulance company can afford to get, so that you can get some kind of standardization, so you have some kind of approximation, like you said, of a human body. Yeah. So short of pulling people in off the street to volunteer, it would be kind of tough.
or doing like a cadaver lab or something along those lines. But no, it's just that I think that's the unique perspective of this, of our dynamic here, is that like, hey, we're experiencing this thing, right? Like, and we're going through the training technique and like the proxy, if you will, of the CPR. And these are the things that pop in my head as we're going through. It's like, I wonder if this is what it's really like. And I think that's the fun part. But bunch of different different things that we learned that night. So airway, big one. The proper rate and how to tell if you're getting the right amount of air in, which is really subtle in terms of like it's just enough to make the chest move.
Well, that was a big point too. Is he was saying is like as much as you want to get air in, you don't want to overinflate.
Yeah. Or so, do it quickly where it's like poof.
Because you can do more damage. You can do damage to the lungs, especially when you get into children. Like they don't have as much volume in their lungs to begin with.
Right.
So that kind of steady over 1 second pulse of air and just looking for that subtle change in the chest instead of like trying to jam as much in there as you can get.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I noticed you and I got into a few, like we're manhand, like we're oafs, right? Like we're like, oh, we're big dudes, and we're grab the bag, and it's like you're the tendency is to like squeeze the hell out of that thing. It's like, nope, we need to like back off that a little bit, like
barotrauma is one of the big things that we're trying to avoid, right? We're not trying to cause additional injuries to our person that we're doing CPR on. If we can avoid it. And so exactly what you're talking about, being more gingerly with our bag valve mask, and our respirations, and especially with little ones, pediatrics.
Yeah.
It's super, super important because you could pop a lung on a kid really, really easily, especially an infant.
Yeah.
The other aspect of it is, if you don't ventilate them enough, right? We talked a little bit about dead space,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of air sitting there because, you know, we have the alveoli down at the bottom of our lungs. That's where we do our gas exchange. And if we don't get enough air moving to get fresh air down to that bottom of those lungs, then we can't.
Right.
We're not being effective.
Right. You're not getting the actual benefit out of the process of,
right,
of trying to do the breaths. I think, respirations, the rescue breathing stuff, mm-hmm, super important. And that was kind of a common theme because, you know, in CPR, that's half the, if you're not doing hands only CPR, that's half the process, right? Is breathing.
Yeah.
And then, for like, you know, once we got used to the idea of doing rescue breaths, like once every 6 seconds seemed to be the kind of, mm-hmm, you know, gold standard is like, hey, that's how often people breathe. We got into the actual CPR stuff, and that's where we got into a lot of things that we talked about in the high quality CPR, yes, aspect. Number one being proper compressions, you know, depth, which for adults was 2 inches, right, Jonathan?
Yeah, 2 inches. Yeah.
About 2 inches. I do have another similar question to the dummy thing. So in those dummies, there's usually some sort of feedback. If you go far enough, you get like a click sound. And if you go too far, you bottom out.
Right.
That seems to be a nuance for me in terms of like, if I get on it, like I'm bottoming out. Like, does that happen often? Like, have you gotten to the point where it's like, oh, I feel like I'm going too deep, or does it feel different in real life?
It feels extremely different in real life.
Okay. So there's no little bell that goes off when you,
there's a little green light, implanted on the side.
People are squishier.
Yeah.
To be quite frank. And then, you know, you've got, the old school saying, oh, you break a rib, but no, it's you're kind of separating cartilage,
yeah,
of the ribs, and you will, upon initially starting CPR on somebody, if you're the one to initiate it, you'll feel a popping sensation.
Like
you
cracking knuckles type thing?
Yeah, like a cracking of the knuckles kind of thing in the chest. So that's always an interesting sensation for somebody's first time providing CPR. But, you know, I mention it because it's something you'll feel.
Right.
And the mannequins don't prepare you for that.
Yeah.
One of the big things about, and I think in this instance, one of the reasons the mannequins are so rigid is because most people are not providing compressions at enough depth,
mm-hmm,
and in real life. And that's probably why they're so rigid. You know, to your point about, you know, and I don't want to jump the gun and talking about it, but to your point about, you know, just going after it and getting after it, that's fine as long as you're allowing full recoil of the chest. Right.
Yeah.
That's a super important part of it. You know, used to be, you know, guys would just stay on the chest. And as you're talking about, you know, you're not allowing that heart to fill back up with blood to be circulated through the body. If you don't allow that full recoil.
Properly. Yeah.
Yeah. And the one instructor had a very, very, interesting, opinion of people that say you should break those ribs. Like
he was very adamant that was
very adamant about it. Adamant. I loved his reaction. I want him as my primary care physician.
Yeah. The sense that like, if you're not doing it right, you'll know you're doing it right if you break a rib. And that's like, the way he was much more eloquent about it. Great. And it makes sense. Like,
yeah,
that doesn't have to be the case.
No.
And it shouldn't necessarily be the benchmark of like, yeah, whether or not you're doing it correctly. Of it.
He's absolutely correct. And I mean, the big thing is like, it's still going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a 95-year-old woman that weighs 80 pounds, you know, or 100 pounds, you might crack some ribs on her. Mm-hmm. And again, we're talking about separating cartilage and not necessarily breaking or fracturing ribs. I'm sure that does happen, but most of the time that sensation is that cartilage. Yep. I've heard the same things through my career, and your instructor's 100% right. That is not a good benchmark of things.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So, key takeaway from when we got into compressions, the CPR itself, obviously proper depth, full recoil. That was emphasized so many times. Yes. It makes total sense as to like, hey, you got to make sure that that heart is inflating, or not inflating, but like filling up with blood, so that when you push it again, it's pushing the blood everywhere that it needs to go. And the right number of compressions. And that is 30 compressions for every two breaths. Mm-hmm. If you're doing CPR with breathing. And if you're doing hands only, it's 30 compressions, but then you do cycles of three for each, right? And then after those three cycles, then you check for vital signs to see if they get spontaneous. What was the term? Spontaneous heartbeat?
Return of spontaneous circulation.
Yes. Rah. Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Return of spontaneous. What was it?
Circulation.
Yeah. So that's CPR, right? Like combining the rescue breaths with the chest compressions in the proper ratio, keeping the blood flowing and the air moving.
Yep.
And it changes sometimes, or it doesn't really change, but
be modified.
How you do it and what you're doing can change based off of how many rescues you have. Yep. Single rescuer CPR seems like a real lot of work.
Yes, it does.
If you're doing all those things together, calling for help, getting on the chest, providing breaths, and doing reassessments, making sure the scene is safe, everything, like you're doing a lot as one person. And then adding in a second person seems like that gets way easier. Like in terms of, hey, it's kind of like driving with a two person team. Like at a certain point, like if you have two people in a car, the driver just drives. So the person who's you know, on the chest just does the chest, just does chest compressions, and the other person does everything else.
Yep.
So like gets the AED ready, gets, you know,
applies, is in charge, pads,
applies pads, does the breathing, calls, can do all the other things. And that seems to be a huge multiplier in terms of kind of providing high quality CPR.
Yep.
So CPR in adults, that's kind of the gist of that. Then we started getting into the differences between that and pediatric CPR, you know, not to go too deep into it, but essentially it's, you know, it's the same thing. You're making sure the air goes in and out. You're making sure that the blood goes round and round, but you're just doing it in different ways based off of the anatomy. So the chest isn't as deep, so, and it's not as strong. You don't need to apply as much pressure. So you're doing chest compressions with
two fingers or your thumbs.
Well, for your infants, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
And we throw terminology around all the time, but, you know, pediatrics, when we think about them, it's anybody that's not an infant.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And then we specify infants. So essentially, when you cannot encircle a child, and they're above a certain weight, then we would start doing regular CPR at an appropriate depth for their age.
Right.
Yeah.
But the principles are the same.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Chest compressions and breaths.
Yep.
But appropriate. Yeah. And sized for their body.
Yep.
Yeah. And one of the biggest aspects, and not to steal your thunder with kids, is they got big heads and that can, if we're laying them on the ground, that can affect how we align the airway. So sometimes you might have to pad under their shoulders
just to get more of a tilt,
to counteract the fact that they have big old noggins and
big old noggins
and Now, that being said, we don't want to hyperextend their airways either, because we can occlude them very easily if we get too much tilt.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So those are some key takeaways when we're dealing with kids.
Yeah. And
doing CPR.
We would kind of describe the difference of how you perform CPR in, say, an infant versus an adult. But this is where I'm going to say that you should go out there and take a class take a CPR training, because it's almost impossible to describe to you how to hold an infant, like performing CPR, like without you just watching a video or going and experiencing it yourself.
Yeah, but getting that training dummy in your hands and manipulating it is something that I think you have to do to be able to completely understand what's going on there.
Yeah. And how you can, you know, how holding a baby to perform life-saving procedures often isn't going to be like what you think of in terms of like how you carry a baby most of the time, where it's like, oh, you're cradling it in your arms. Like, no, you have to do certain manipulations with keeping that baby on a forearm and kind of holding it in certain ways and smacking its back to get, you know, foreign objects out. If you're doing, if there's like a choking incident. So without going too deep in there, I would advocate that, like, hey, you should really take a class and, or look into it further for, like, you know, real instruction. But just know that, like, if you go through this type of stuff, you're going to see some interesting things that you may not realize. Yep. Like, oh, well, that's how I can hold a baby. Yeah. Yep. When you need to do CPR, that's how you got to hold them. That was kind of like the gist of it.
Yep.
Like we got into choking emergencies a little bit, you know, which I found it funny. They did not mention the word Heimlich at all.
Not once.
Did nobody use the Heimlich maneuver?
Not once.
I mean, it's a general maneuver.
It's the maneuver.
I don't know. I don't know if it's a thing of, and somebody else probably could tell us, but if it's a thing of getting away from,
like, specific medical. Yeah.
Well, getting away from that terminology, because that is a gentleman's name.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. He came up with it and it's named after him. And so I don't know
if Dr. Heimlich.
Royalties thing at this point, or if the term abdominal thrust actually more correctly encompasses what we're going to be doing.
Right.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm not back blows and abdominal thrust. Yeah. Right.
No, it's way more intuitive when you say abdominal thrust.
Yes.
Yeah.
However, if you really want a good time, and if you really want to see a really funny, like a funny bit, one of my favorite comedians is Eddie Izzard. Are you guys familiar with him? He does a bit on how Dr. Heimlich produced and developed the Heimlich maneuver. Is hilarious. It's probably one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Basically, it's like, how did he come up with the Heimlich maneuver? Like, you know, well, okay, Hans, I need you to swallow this golf ball. And he's like, oh, yes, you cannot breathe. Okay. Now let me hit you with this frying pan. No, that did not work. Okay, next person. Okay, I need you to swallow this golf ball. And then, you know, it's like, okay, so eventually they got to the hoocha, hoocha, hoocha. You know, the chest compression.
Yes.
But he does it much funnier.
That's funny.
I love him. So we did some choking emergencies, the chest compress, or sorry, not abdominal thrusts. And that kind of like encompassed the whole night. The CPR, infant CPR. Oh, and the only other thing that we really got a bunch of hands-on practice with is AEDs.
Yes.
Automated external defibrillators, or at least the training models that were there, which were a bit finicky. However,
they could be. Yeah.
They seem to turn off on their own. I don't think they do that in real life.
I think that's definitely a training function for sure.
Yeah. So it doesn't keep beeping at you.
But it was very, very straightforward. It's kind of hard to mess it up. All the instructions are right there.
It tells you what to do.
Yeah. It vocally tells you what to do. Even with the pads, like on the pads, it's showing you where to put them. I think it's kind of hard to mess that up. So I think the AED is one of those things where it's designed that way so that someone that's never used one before can open it up and effectively use it.
Yeah. Super simple.
Yeah.
You know, applying pads.
Yep.
Listening to directions. Even a caveman could do it.
I think so.
You know, which we have proven.
Yes.
But yeah, so I think this was a fun night because it was hands-on. I like the hands-on stuff. Yes. One that I'm sure, you know, I will say it was not extraneous. Like what I will appreciate about it is like, they were like, hey, you're going to get in, you're going to learn the stuff. We're going to get you, you know, get you going. We're not going to belabor everything.
Yeah.
Because I find that this is probably one of those ones that we're going to get, like, you're not going to know like the realness, like you're going to learn it on the job.
Yep.
Like this, and you should know how to do it before you go to get out there. But the real experience is going to come from clinical hours and doing, mm-hmm. and doing the role as an EMT. And like, you know, certain things, I don't think my brain is going to grasp this until I do it for real.
The interesting thing about this is, though, this is kind of, I think, everyone's first introduction to like this kind of training is a CPR class. Like, it's kind of ubiquitous. Like
first aid.
Yeah. Like this is kind of where things start. So it's an interesting thing only because it kind of is that entryway for everyone else.
Yep. So yeah, a lot of good learning this week. With that, I think we've kind of gone through the CPR stuff. Unless Jonathan, any particular instances, you know, do any of them stick in your brain from your years, like the first time you ever had to perform CPR? Was that a big moment for you?
It does stick in my mind, actually. It's something that you won't ever forget. One of the things that I want to talk about with it is kind of your own physical response and psychological response to it. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, you know, I can't say enough to prepare a person for that. But your body goes through its own sort of stress response. And Mike and Max and myself, we all are familiar with that with some of the other training we've done. But this was probably one of the earliest exposures I ever had to that stress response. Mm-hmm. I remember being tunnel visioned. I remember, you know, having some temporal dilation where things slowed down.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember this very, very, readily. And, you know, it was just an odd sensation that I really had to think my way through. And sometimes it's still like that because it is very much a like, hurry up. We've got to hurry. We've got to get there. But then once we start getting things in place, we really have to slow down and start to actually start thinking. And that can be hard to do. People get caught up in the moment and it can be hard to do, but you've got to let your cooler head prevail in this instance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I this may be an odd thing for our listeners to hear, but you know, because of our tactical training that we've talked about and our firearms training we've talked about, it's the same sort of analogy of, when I draw my gun, it's a drag race. But as soon as I go to start shooting my gun, that's when I really need to focus in on the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
And so making that determination and starting those compressions, that's that drag race.
Yeah.
And then once we get that stuff started and taken care of, then we really need to think about some additional things. Okay, now we need to think about, can we get a more definitive airway?
Mm-hmm.
Can we start to get some intravenous or interosseous access so we can give some medications? Have we checked to see if the person's blood sugar is low? Is that what caused them to go into cardiac arrest? Right? Did they have an overdose on some sort of drug or medication? Can we fix that?
Yeah.
And that's sort of like the thinking part of it.
Right.
Yeah. Speed up when you can speed up, and then you know,
think when you need to think.
And those two things.
It is truly performing CPR in the field should be controlled chaos at some point. You should, once you get all the resources there, it should slow down and you should be working as a team and trying to just really figure it out. But until you do it a few times, and I mean, you know, maybe even I had done CPR, you know, 20 or 30 times before that really clicked with me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And truly the way we do CPR in the field as EMS providers has changed. When I started in my career, we would take everybody to the hospital, no matter what, in the back of a moving ambulance, we would be doing CPR and we would speed to the ER and be bounced all around the back. And are we doing really good compressions? Probably not. And so that was an issue, but we would take everybody to the hospital, and then at the hospital, that's where they're pronounced dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we don't do that anymore. A, because it's unsafe to transport people like that and transport your crew like that.
Yeah.
Number two, everything that they're going to do in that emergency department, an ALS staffed ambulance is going to be able to do for somebody in cardiac arrest.
Right.
And then number three is the effectiveness of doing CPR while we're transporting. It's right. just not effective.
Right.
It's not effective. You're not giving that person the best chance. So we have, as a profession, kind of slowed it down and made it a more methodical process. And I think that's the standard across the board for most services. I can't think of any place off the top of my head that's still doing the load and go and the CPR while they're running down the road.
Yeah, like a wheeled gurney being rolled yeah. with a person on top of it providing CPR type thing.
Yeah, that still happens sometimes okay. if you're moving between like the ambulance into like a resuscitation bay in the sure, hospital. Yeah. Because we do want to keep on those chest.
Oh yeah, absolutely,
super super important. But that should be the exception and not the rule.
Yeah,
gotcha. You know. I've got a student tip that relates to CPR. So whenever we get to that portion of tonight, I'll tell a little story.
Okay.
Awesome. For the students.
Cool. I do have one kind of last question for you in terms of like the real world aspect of CPR. And this, I don't know if this popped into my head while we were in class. So I'm sure I could probably find a statistic somewhere, but in your experience, how often is a call where you are resorting to CPR? Mm-hmm. Like how often, like, you know, on average, how many people get saved from it?
Oh man.
Is it,
That's a tough one.
And it's going to be, I'm sure it's going to be different for every provider out there, but
let me say this, because what I'll say is my own anecdotal experience.
Right.
I have performed CPR with it not leading to ROSC more times than not, significantly. That being said, got a couple back.
Yeah.
Right.
And without right. it, those couple wouldn't have come back.
Yeah, they would
right.
have
been.
Right.
So yeah. it's.
When we're talking about CPR, we're talking about giving somebody a chance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not like television. We're not getting every code back. Doesn't happen that way. That's yeah. the reality of it. But those statistics are out there as far as like. I couldn't spout them off to you.
It's fine. I'm just curious if it was a general trend that you've seen in terms of like a rough at like I and you described it. It's like more often than not, it has led to spontaneous
return of spontaneous. Yeah. Yeah, it's.
But for this few that you got back, it's worth all that effort.
And even then, sometimes you get somebody back long enough for their family to come to the ER
right. sure.
and to have a goodbye. And and really, you know, there's something to be said for that.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, there's something to be said for that. Everything to be said about giving a chance.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Because without it, there's right. none. And
I wasn't even necessarily directly involved in the initial onset of this particular instance. But the one that sticks out to me the most is we had a little old lady, her family was basically pushing her out the door and we're like, whoa, we're trying to figure out what's going on. Get her in the ambulance. As soon as we get her in the ambulance, my partner's in the back because I was driving for this particular call. They're like, hey, she's coding. And so these two studs in the back, they, you know, throw the AED pads on her and start compressions immediately. And we got her back. I jump in once we get to the hospital. We ask for the hospital to come out and give us some help, and they're being finicky about it. So we're in the back of the ambulance doing CPR for about 5 minutes before they come out and help us. And but we got her back, and she lived another several years. She got to go home because of that early intervention.
Yeah.
CPR is only effective if we start it immediately. That's why that recognition and those early compressions and that early AED use are so important. Even then, it's still a slim chance, but we're giving people a chance.
Yeah. And I think that's the perfect way to kind of wrap this up in terms of the real world. It's like all of this stuff leads to better outcomes and real world successes. Yeah. So, cool stuff. CPR, you should go out there and learn it. Even if you're not going to EMT school, which you'll learn it there, but, I highly, like, if anything, hopefully somebody from this that listens to this will go, you know what, let me go make sure I'm up to date on my CPR cert. So, okay. So, I think that pretty much, is a good wrap up for CPR and what we learned in this week's, class, and, still more to come. I'm sure we'll get into CPR a bunch more, but we have a tools of the trade for you tonight.
So tonight we're going to talk about this scoop stretcher.
The scoop stretcher. Is that related to ice cream in any way, shape?
Yes, it's mainly made for vanilla, no chocolate. I mean,
but what about the rocky road?
No, nothing with any kind of texture.
Oh,
plain
okay.
Vanilla. Scoop stretcher is also known as the clamshell or orthopedic stretcher. It is a device that's used by emergency services, and the idea being that it actually can come apart.
Okay, so it's the one that we've been using in class, right? So it's a metal skeletonized stretcher.
Yep.
And it has two clamps, like two robust metal clips at the top, at the head end and the toe end.
Right. And down the center, there's no attachment. So as you look down the stretcher, once you get there's a portion that adjusts for height and length of the patient. And then at the top end, there are these beveled up pieces of metal that don't touch together. So if you have a patient that has an orthopedic injury, or you have a patient where there's some other concern, instead of having to log roll them onto like a backboard or some other kind of stretcher, even the Reeve stretcher, we had to log roll them for that one.
Mm-hmm.
You're able to put it together underneath them. So you're not going to jostle the patient as much. You're not going to potentially further injure spinal injuries. You could also say the same thing for any kind of a broken leg or appendage.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you an option where you're not having to move the patient to get them onto an apparatus that you're able to move them. And then you're able to move them out of the situation into either the wheeled stretcher or into the ambulance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there was a lot of love for the scoop stretcher amongst the instructors. And I would have thought, I just because I'd never seen one before taking EMT training, that looking at it, it's like, if it seems archaic, but seeing it in use and like when we started practicing like cervical spine stuff, seeing how that worked in terms of like, oh, you don't even have to move the patient. You can literally keep them as still as possible and get this thing under them and still have a rigid system that you can lift them with. Made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think any situation where you don't want to move the patient any more than they've already been moved, or you know, however they've injured themselves, it's just a smart idea to me. The other neat thing I found out is apparently many of the models are radiolucent. So they can put them right into x-rays and CT machines.
Radiolucent.
Yes.
Oh, that's a term. We'll have to put that as a medical term of the week one week because I've never heard of that.
I never would have expected you could, but I guess whatever it's made of, some kind of an alloy, you can put it right into an x-ray machine, right into a CT.
It scanner. Doesn't show up on, or which it makes sense interfere
for
with,
a patient that has a spinal injury.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it would certainly cool. makes sense with that. Do you use scoop stretchers a bunch or at all, Jonathan?
Over my career, we haven't used them a tremendous amount, but what I'll say is the times that I have used them, primarily for like hip fractures, those have been the times where, because those are extremely painful injuries, mm-hmm. Those have been the times where I've seen the most benefit from them.
Because rolling somebody with a potential hip fracture is
right. Yeah, it's gotta be and usually it's a thing of like, we're going to use this to get this person up and then put them on the actual stretcher.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's not something that's utilized often, but it's still a good tool to have in your, arsenal, as far as dealing with orthopedic injuries and hip fractures and things like that. So,
And one thing the one instructor pointed out is that one thing negative about them is they need maintenance.
Yeah.
They have to be oiled. They have to be lubed. If not, then like he said, most times if that's the case, they just get put to the side because no one wants to maintain them, and then you don't have it as an option. Even the one we had trying to get the latches when we were putting it back together, and the one latch was very stiff.
Yes.
By the second or third time, it seemed like it wanted to move a little better. But that first time, like, it just did that little clip did not want to come out.
Well, anything with moving parts is going to
100%
is going to be a more prone to failure and wear as other stuff. So it's a relatively simple tool with some moving parts, including the extenders on it.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because you can see, and maybe it's just the age of that particular device, but it was actually cracking. Like there was a bit of a stress fracture on it, and that we had noticed in the class. Turns out it works just fine still. But like that was one of the things that somebody had noticed at one point. Is like, well, it's more prone to those types of things just based on its general design. Right. Like, and it has more moving parts, so more things can fail, and it needs to be maintained and lubed and
all the things.
And it does require a bit of manual dexterity in terms of like. Being able to put those things together while pressing the clip and pushing the things together. I did find that
your technique was way better.
Well, yeah, I did learn after we did it like 8 times or so that like it's way easier that if you're using a scoop stretcher that I have found to connect it at the head end first instead of the foot end because there's less weight where the feet are. And actually the way that the stretcher works is that it doesn't actually really support much weight at the foot end, but it really cradles the shoulders and the abdomen and the hips. So if you connect it at the head end first, where you have to scoop that thing under the patient's weight and the friction between the patient and the ground, if you get that end in first, you can use the other end, the foot end, as more of a lever to pull that together. Yep. And all of a sudden it goes way easier.
It went from being a struggle of three people trying to get the silly clip to go to, oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know what inspired, like, I definitely had the thought of, like, I bet you that's a lot easier if you do it the other way.
Yeah,
like,
you were correct.
If you clip it at the head end first and then do the foot end. But, you know, sometimes you won't have that luxury, so you got to know how to do it from both ends.
Absolutely.
Cool. So that is our tool of the trade for this week, and that brings us to something Jonathan alluded to before, a tip for students that may be going on their clinical runs.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been talking about CPR this whole time and talked about the various aspects of it and performing it. And here's my advice and here's my tip to everybody. Get in your mind that when you go on your first clinical shift, you may be doing CPR on this first clinical shift, and maybe even very early. I had a student one time, it was her first clinical shift, and you know, we're going through the truck check and talking to her kind of about, you know, expectations of the day and does she have expectations and what she'd like to learn and work on and going through all that. And within the first 30 minutes of the shift, as we're going through that process, we get a call for a cardiac arrest, and she's going from talking about it to doing it
live.
And so she's having to, and we don't throw her to the wolves. We got her through that process, but mentally prepare yourself that you may be doing CPR as soon as you get there in the morning at shift change, and it's your first clinical shift. So just prepare yourself.
Mm-hmm. I like it. Be ready. Stay prepared.
Be ready.
Stay prepared. It's almost like it's a moniker that keeps getting repeated over and over again.
It's one I learned early in life.
Yeah. Yes, you did.
Be prepared.
Young Scout Michael.
Yes. It's a recurring theme. It's one that I hold very dear to my heart.
You should.
Pretty much all the time. With that, I think we've certainly kind of covered the
we've plumbed the depths of CPR.
What do we have coming up next? What's next week, Max?
So next week is just basically talking about a review. So our next chapter is basically a review of everything we've done in section one. So this is right. All everything you've seen up till now has been covering section one of the book that we're of working our out of.
Yeah.
So next week we're basically talking about, you know, where we're at with things, maybe highlighting certain key things that kind of caught our eye during the first section of instruction, and kind of where we're at with things, with the training, with the podcast, what we're doing with this.
We'll do a little bit of a review of where we're at episode 8.
And also things that you're doing.
Yep. And
Jonathan's doing.
Yeah.
I have yet to do.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that in the next episode, but, you know, lots coming, and thank you all for taking the ride with us. We'll see you next time on the Ride Along.
See you guys.
This podcast is for educational and storytelling purposes only. It is not medical advice or official EMT training. Always follow your accredited instructors and local protocols. Heartbeats racing.